Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I'm Ron Yates, professor of journalism and the head of the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois. I'm pinch hitting today for David Enge. Today we're going to be taking a look at Japan, specifically Japan as seen through the eyes of one of its most insightful observers, a man named Donald Ritchie. Mr. Ritchie is the author of a new book called The Donald Ritchie Reader, 50 Years of Writing on Japan, published by Stonebridge Press just this year. Donald Ritchie has been called one of the three or four most accomplished writers on Japan in the world, and that's a very heady company when you consider people like Lafcadio Hearn, Ruth Benedict, Edmund Reischauer, who are generally regarded as some of the best observers and translators of Japan for the rest of the world. Donald will be joining us from Detroit by telephone. I think few people have been able to write about Japan over such a long span of time, from New Year's Eve of 1946 until today. And it's a view of Japan that few of us have, including me, even though I spent almost 10 years there as a foreign correspondent between the mid-1970s, the 1980s, and into the early 90s. Before we get to our questions and our interview with Donald Ritchie, I want to remind you that you're invited to join the conversation by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Those numbers, again, are 333-9455 or 333-WILL locally and toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Welcome to Focus 580, Mr. Ritchie.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't know if you and I actually ran into one another in Japan in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I suspect we might have bumped into one another at the Foreign Correspondents Club, because I suspect that's a place you probably spent some time.
No, I'm a member, right.
Right. Well, one of the things that I think that your perspective of Japan is truly unique, not only in its depth, but in its breadth. Like few Americans have lived so long in Japan and have seen the changes that you've seen. And I guess one of the first things I'd like to ask you is, what are the most striking changes that you've seen in your 50 years of writing about Japan? And maybe just leave it at that one. What are the most striking changes you've seen?
Well, the changes have been pretty dramatic, because when I first went there, of course, there wasn't really any Japan left, nor any Tokyo, certainly. There are only three major cities which hadn't been completely obliterated. And so I was there pretty much at ground zero, and then I watched things recover after that. So I went through the occupation, and then I watched the cities grow up again. Then I watched the new affluence, and then I watched business get back on its feet. And then I watched that brief period during which Japan managed to eclipse everybody else. And then I was witness to the Great Recession, and now I'm witness to the Great Depression.
Is that what they're calling it now, the Great Depression?
No, that's what I'm calling it.
What about, one of the most striking things in your book that I found really fascinating, and having lived in Tokyo myself for a while, it's an unusual thing to even think about, and that's being able to see Mount Fuji from the Ginza, which is the heart of downtown Tokyo. And that's something that you were able to do in 1946, right?
Yes, that's true. I was working at an office which was out near the Ginza. And after work, we would stroll down to the corner, the Fortome corner, and look at Fuji, because there was really nothing in between us and it. Everything else had been reduced to a burned-out plain. All of the wooden structures in Tokyo at that point, it was mainly wooden, had all been burned. And there was Fuji right on the horizon, just as Hokusai and Hiroshige had seen it. And as no one else had, because Tokyo had been a great city before and been built up. But even as I watched, just in the weeks that followed, I was able to see new facades going up. And little by little, by the end of the year, Fuji was no longer visible.
And I don't think you can see it at all from Tokyo today, maybe on an occasional very clear day.
There's one avenue in Aoyama, which being an avenue, they haven't cluttered it up yet. And so you can see the top of Fuji on a very, very clear day.
Mm. You know, I asked you before what the most striking changes were that you've seen in the 50 years that you've been writing about Japan. I suspect there are also some very subtle changes that you might be able to talk about.
Oh, yes. Besides the big economic changes, there's all sorts of subtle changes that come in the wake of big economic changes. A lot of the changes in attitude has to do with Japanese ideas themselves. When I was first there, of course, it was a nation which had been both, you know, demoralized and revitalized by the war and its destruction. And so people were questioning themselves as to who they were and everything. Well, when you question yourself like this, it's very fruitful activity. You always end up with answers. And so this new self-identification as Japanese, given the times, took a sort of an economic turn, and everybody decided they were truly middle class, whether they were or not, and had those aspirations, all of which changed the face of the country then. And before the war, the idea of, you know, of a capitalistic imperative of defining your worth and the amount of money you owned, this is was not particularly to be met with. But after the war and the American occupation, capitalism as a way of life took on with a vengeance, and so consequently, with everybody working hard, having already been a Japanese virtue, a Confucius virtue transferred from before the war, money was to be made out of this, and so consequently, you would find a number of things that had been admired, quotidian things, you know, things in which poverty was the attraction. One of the things about Japan is that most of its existence has been spent in what we would call abject poverty. And so a lot of the Japanese ways of doing things, a lot of the arts and so forth, I mean, if you don't have anything but mud, then you make marvelous pottery, which is what the Japanese have done. When you don't have enough money for furniture, then you make a whole aesthetic of space, which is called ma, and this is what the Japanese also have done. However, when you have money enough not to muddle about with mud anymore, and when you have, you know, to buy every new gadget that gets in and fill up your space that way, then consequently these virtues, these ideas, they go away and they are supplemented by something else, which is usually more common, like owning or, you know, decorating or something like that. And so this sort of thing has become rampant until just recently, but now that the economy has failed pretty much and that it is revealed that the prosperity was based upon the foundation, not as secure as many people thought. Now, a lot of the old ideas about space and time and about being Japanese are coming back again. This is there's nothing sinister in this, but it is a kind of a retro, a kind of revision to ideas as to who the Japanese are. During the Rich period, the idea that we Japanese are a very separate tribe, nobody can understand us, our language is the most difficult in the world, all of this was used to keep them together. Like, you know, you look to the other in order to define who you are, to decide how you are. Americans look at Mexico and say, I'm glad we're not Mexican, we're this instead. But they wouldn't know who they were unless the Mexicans were there to tell them what they're not. In the same way, the Japanese use, all peoples do this, of course, use neighbors or use everything to find out what they're not. In Japan, usually it's the foreigner, it's the other. And so we're not there. Therefore, we are Japanese. So during the big productive years of money and so forth, this was a very handy thing to use, and it accounted for the trade imbalance and a lot of other things, you know, closed markets on the part of the Japanese. Now that this is no longer true, Japan is loosening up and realizing that it is really just as as populous, just as varied, just as variegated, just as mongrel as any other country is. There's a much more human cast as we would, you know, in the Western idea of humanism, now in Japan, thanks to poverty, than there has been during any of the other decades that I've been there.
You know, one of the things that you always hear about Japan when you've lived there at all is there's this us and them mentality. There's this sense that somehow Japan was irrevocably altered by the occupation period and has resulted in this kind of relationship with the United States, for example, of which Japan is the child and the United States is the parent. And I heard this a lot in the 70s and 80s. I suspect it's probably not quite as prevalent today, but there's still that sense of we hear of some kind of a inferiority complex vis-a-vis the United States and perhaps the West that used to be prevalent in Japan, or at least the perception was that it that was there. Is that still something which exists, or is that just a figment of an American's imagination?
No, I think it exists, but I think it mutates a lot. Originally, in the Meiji period, when Japan was forced to open up, didn't want to, did so at the worst deal in the world, then catching up with the West became a national passion. However, Japan caught up with the West in the 70s, 80s, partially in the 90s, at least financially. And economically, being on the top of the heap, the idea of racing, in order to catch up was completely gone. Also, everything that had been raced for had been captured. Things foreign have been, to a large amount, all accounted for, and all has been modified to the extent that they can now fit within Japanese cultural concepts and have become, to all effects, Japanese. So there isn't anything out there. The fish pool has been fished out. There's very few things that the Japanese want that they don't have already. Again, nothing sinister in this. This is something we all do. We all look abroad, take what we want, turn it into our own purpose, and it's called progress. And this is what the Japanese have proved they adapt at. And so English is taken over and takes very funny forms indeed. And, you've heard many jokes about shopping bags and T-shirts. But the point is it's not brand of English. It's a sub-branch of Japanese. Mm. And it's used for entirely different purposes. It's not used for communication. It's not meant to be funny. Indeed, the idea that it is in Congress is beside its own point, which is simply to point out that the use of English has become a trendy. It's become a popular thing to do, to be seen wearing an English T-shirt is to indicate that you're with it, that you're cool. The message does not mean anything. It is all in the signifier. What's signified is not important to anybody. Now, there's a little bit too much English around to be exclusive, so people are going into Cyrillic alphabet, or more recently now into the more arcane Sinhalese, Thai alphabets, which are very different indeed from the Japanese, which simply means that I am with the trends. I am at the cutting edge of whatever it is.
Donald, I just want to interrupt you very quickly. We've got a problem with our connection, and what we'd like to do is to call you right back and see if we can get this connection. Apparently, there's some kind of a problem with the sound quality, and we'd like to call you right back and hook up again, if that's okay. We've been talking with Donald Ritchie, who has been one of the great observers of Japan since 1946 when he first went to Japan. Donald Ritchie has just written a new book called The Donald Ritchie Reader, 50 Years of Writing on Japan. He's doing a book tour of the United States right now. And let me tell you a little bit about Donald Ritchie's background while we've got this minute to get him reconnected from Detroit. He was born in Lima, Ohio in 1924, and in 1941 he left home and hitchhiked to New Orleans, enlisted in the U.S. Maritime Service, or the Merchant Marine, and wound up going to North Africa, Southern Europe, and eventually to Shanghai, all during World War II. And after World War II, he was hired by the Civil Service as a typist in occupied Japan, and he arrived in Okinawa Bay on New Year's Eve of 1946. Eventually, he made his way to Tokyo, which had been devastated by U.S. air raids during the war, at the age of 22, and he began working as a film reviewer for the Pacific Stars and Stripes, the U.S. military newspaper. And at that point, that's when he began exploring Japan and learning about Japan. And the only way you can learn about it, and that's by being there. He has since gone into other areas of Japanese culture, including film. And I guess, Donald, what I'd like to ask you is, what attracted a young man from Lima, Ohio, to Japan back in 1946?
Well, strictly, speaking, nothing did, because when you go away and you go halfway around the world, either you're going towards something or you're going away from something. In my case, I was at full retreat from Lima, Ohio. And where I went didn't really make so much difference as the fact that I was going at all. During the war, I had gone to Europe a great deal. I was in the Merchant Marine. And after the war, I did not want to return to Ohio. And so I discovered that the Foreign Service had jobs open for people in the two occupied areas, Germany and Japan, and I was sent to Japan. My talent is that I am a typing champion. I know how to type very swiftly and somewhat accurately, because it's not a distinction I'm fond of. I don't like to type and everything. So as soon as I got out there, I got out of my typing position and went to Stars and Stripes. Things were so fluid back then, you could move around a great deal better than you could several years later. Informed that they did not have a film critic. They did not, and they made me one. So I reviewed Betty Grable for the troops for two or three years.
Before we get back to our question with Donald Ritchie, I just want to remind you that that you're invited to join the conversation by calling us at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. I think one of the enduring themes for anybody who spent any time at all in Japan is the question of westernization or internationalization or what the Japanese call kokusai tekina, whatever. And I just wonder how international, I'm using quotations around that word, is the Japan of 2001 as opposed to the Japan of, say, 1946?
It looks a good deal more international. I mean, it looks like Blade Runner. In fact, Blade Runner got its looks by Ridley Scott coming over and looking at Shinjuku at night, and that became the world of Blade Runner. So It's very, very, cusp of the new. It's very, the architecture is fantastic. And, great towers every place, and then all the latest gadgets and anything you want to buy. I mean, my little Japanese supermarket near where I live has sour cream, so I can do, Western confections and stuff. In actuality, how much? Until now, I might have said that, the surface changes, but the core holds. And amid all this, ancient Japanese virtues and vices still exist. But I don't belong to that school anymore. Having been there long enough, I now realize that this museum that I lived in is being razed, and that whole halls that I thought would last forever, wings, are now being, bald before my eyes. So I believe that Japan is in for great change. It makes sense. I mean, what we've been watching, what we've been calling Japan all of these years, is really the product of an erosion. And you can only erode so much. Japan is centuries deep, and so it took a very long time for the erosion to be noticeable. But now it is such that there are very few, even interior, quote, Japanese, unquote, things like lifetime occupation or, stay on the bureaucratic escalator and get to the top. No matter how dumb you are, you still got money and position. All of this is stopped. You get out of high school and you get a good job if you get out of Tokyo University and you get a really good job. This is stopped. Everything, like Marx says, turns out to be economically based. And so with Japan in violent depression now, it means that a lot of the old virtues are vanishing, a lot of the things that we thought absolutely permanent. So far as playing futurology with Japan as anybody's game, I would imagine that's going to be a period where Japan sort of looks like the new Los Angeles. And it's going to act like it, and then little by little, I would imagine it's going to build a new national entity, which will be based upon some sort of new economy.
Back in the, I guess it's the late 70s, I guess it was Herman Kahn who made these incredible predictions about Japan being the new leader of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, in the 1980s, when the bubble was really getting large in Japan, everybody was beginning to believe it. And, of course, now we've seen after the bubble has burst that that may not be the case. Were all these predictions, what drove those predictions about Japan and the Japanese, I wonder?
Well, they were self-serving. For example, when Ezra Vogel decided that it was Japan as number one, instantly the book was translated and he became a national hero. Khan also became extremely popular because of this. And once it is heard from an authority, and because of the war and its loss, the Japanese continue to regard America even now as an authority, then it makes it sort of real. So in a way, both Khan and Vogel made it happen by simply magically insisting that it was there. However, now that the unendurable has occurred, you don't hear Khan and Vogel spoken of so much anymore. There is not a feeling of panic, but there's a feeling of a new seriousness in which the ways of Japan, the fact that the way things are done is really still now the way things were done in 1850, that what is needs to be restructured is the entire structure itself, what passed for holding the country together 150 years ago can obviously no longer do so. And yet we find the place entrenched with bureaucracies, all of which are only concerned, like all bureaucracies, with defending their own space. The best analysis, I think, is that of Carl von Wolfram. And anybody who reads The Enigma of Japanese Power, even though it was written 10 years ago, can see writ large the present dilemma.
Right. We've got a caller from Downs on line 4. I'll take that call. And hello, you're on with Donald Ritchie.
Hello.
Yes.
We lived in Japan for a time around 1980, and I was very interested. I knew no men socially because that's the way the society at least then was, certainly. But I was very interested in women because I had thought that women didn't work, and as our son was going to Yochen and we lived in a large apartment building, I realized that a great many women that I knew who had young children but who were in school were working part-time. I also had contacts in some traditional dyeing industries, and there you had the cottage industry where the whole family was involved. But I'm wondering what has happened to women since then, whether they are working, whether they're moving into full-time, mainstream kind of jobs.
Right. Since that time, women have taken off. For one thing, it has been discovered that this is a new workforce, and that and originally the attraction was that women could be made to work for less wages than men, since we don't have any legal equal right laws on this. But nowadays, to get women, you have to pay them as much as men, and further than that, you have to treat them as well as you treat men. So the idea of a secondary minority, as it were, third world force with women simply has not worked out. And women have taken economic hold of the country to a large extent. There are many, many women in professions now, many women lawyers, many women doctors, and so forth. Up until 5 or 6 years ago, there'd be a token woman, perhaps, in the governmental office. Now there are real women, the Secretary of State, as it were, is a very able woman indeed. She has an awful lot of flack to encounter, but nonetheless, she's doing it well and bravely.
Are you talking about Tanaka?
I'm talking about Tanaka. Mm-hmm. And so up to 10 years ago, you'd say, five lawyers get together and the one that's female makes the tea. This is no longer true. This is no women have not been given the right to, they have taken the right to pull. Also, economically, on the street, women now have most of the buying power. There's a theory that Japan has always been a disguised matriarchy anyway. And now women have all the money. They give their husbands the allowance because they have to pay for the home and the kids and so forth, and that's more important than any husband is. And so having all this, they now know what to buy because the media has been following them and nobody else. So all the media is women-oriented, and because they have the money and they can spend it. And so all advertisers know this. In addition, a large amount of money is from these new women who are new wage earners, and they have a considerable amount of money since most of them still live at home. Those who don't like this call them the parasitical generation because they live at home and they don't offer anything to their parents. And they're the ones who put their money together, and they go on trips, usually together without men. trips abroad, very often you see onsen filled with young women, all enjoying themselves and being with each other, and rather vocal in their assertion that they don't intend to get married, that they don't need men, that they don't want to have children at this point, that they have their careers. This would seem to be the ideal of every Japanese woman now. So it's very widespread. The idea of, you know, a good wife, wise mother has really just sort of evaporated.
I know one of the stories I did back in the 80s was the decline of the birth rate in Japan to the point where officials, bureaucrats were getting really worried about the future of Japan in terms of the next generation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, with the world getting more and more fractious, where are they going to get their cannon fodder?
Do you think you and I will ever see a woman as Prime Minister of Japan?
Excuse me?
You think you or I will ever see a woman as Prime Minister of Japan?
I think it is more possible now than ever. I think it's about as possible as a woman president for a man.
Mm-hmm. That's the big question. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
I have another call from Urbana. Hello, you're on with Donald Ritchie.
Line one?
Yes, line one.
I would like to continue the previous caller's line of questioning. Would you talk about family life and fathers in Japan? I had seen a movie within the last few years that indicated that a lot of businessmen stopped off someplace on the way home to either go to a bar or whatever, and so they came home very late and wonder, you know, do fathers parent very much?
Okay. This indeed used to be the pattern. The idea was that you didn't leave home, you didn't leave work because it looked bad be leaving early, you know, you're deserting the team, and then to go out afterwards, and you were encouraged to go out, because then you could badmouth the boss, and you could get it off you, and you could do, so you know, socio-bonding, and this is very good for the company, and you've been a warrior for finance, everything. This is all stopped. You simply don't behave in that way anymore. I have a student who's one of my students, and she got married, and I said, look, you're going to lead an awful life. And she said, well, we'll do it somehow. And I went out to see her, and sure enough, the husband wasn't there. And I said, see? He said, yes, he's there. And she said, no, it's different. He always gets off early, but then he goes to a coffee shop and reads, or else he goes to a movie or something. Then he comes home about 9 o'clock. And I say, why on earth is that? And she said, you really don't know Japan very well. If the neighbors saw him coming home at 6, they would think he wasn't getting on with his job properly, and they would gossip about it. And I was truly shocked when I heard that, because it means that the degree of internalization that makes it very shocking for me to have heard that. I hadn't realized this. Since then, however, things have changed a lot. What it used to happen was that the husband would not come home, and so the wife, the only male she would have would be the male child in her life, whom she would, educate continually, you know, telling what was dangerous and what wasn't. And so a whole generation of little nerds were created, little otakus, and we're still suffering from that. You see a boy and a girl out, she'll be in cashmere and pearls, and he'll be in his hip-hop pants with his baseball hat on backwards, and you think, mother and child. But it's not. It's a couple on a date. The women are so much more mature. The boys really can only be charitably called immature. A lot of the reasons that the girls don't want to get married is they don't want to get married to boys like this.
Mm.
So the idea of, you know, of a very possessive education mama, they're called, Kyoiku mama, who is at home, you know, pushing the boy and stultifying him at everything because that's the only outlet for her emotions. This is a very real thing, but it's not so common as it used to be.
Donald, I'd like to share with our listeners a couple of passages out of the book. This is from the chapter called Japanese Shapes. I really found this fascinating because I guess anybody who's ever spent any time in Japan can identify with this. And let me read a couple of passages here. Man is the only one among the animals to make patterns, and among men, the Japanese are probably the foremost pattern makers. They are a patterned people who live in a patterned country, a land where habit is exalted to right, where the exemplar still exists, where there is a model for everything and the ideal is actively sought, where the shape of an idea or an action may be as important as its content, where the configuration of parts depends upon recognized form, and the profile of the country depends upon the shape of living. The profile is visible. To think of Japan is to think of form. But beneath this, a social pattern also exists. There is a way to pay calls, a way to go shopping, a way to drink tea, a way to arrange flowers, a way to owe money. A formal absolute exists and is aspired to. Social form must be satisfied if social chaos is to be avoided. To me, that says a lot about Japan. And I'm just wondering, this is a view which do you think a lot of Westerners or Americans or foreigners living in Japan actually understand that?
Yeah, very few when it was actually occurring. But of course, nowadays, that what I wrote was true, but it's archaeology. Things are not like that now. Now that the young people have no idea of what this must have been like. I mean, you eat your Big Mac on the street, you leave your paper, you know, on the corner, and you slop around, and you know, you do things as you want to. The rigorousness of Japanese civilization has almost vanished. Only people of certain generations, certainly my generation, and the ones under it. But the new generation has not been educated, nor has it had the necessity for this. And so you find a new generation in which there's a new etiquette of cell phone usage going up, a new etiquette of how to use your internet and how not to, a new etiquette of this and that. And I don't know enough about this to tell if the structure of the old is being continued in the new or not. But all the continuations, I still believe the Japanese are great pattern makers, and I think out of this will come new patterns of behavior. Mm. But the ones that I was celebrating in my writing simply don't exist anymore, at least among the young people.
Now, I think back in the 80s, there was a word that was being tossed around quite a bit, and the word was Shinjin Rui, which was this new generation, so to speak.
That's
of
right,
Japanese.
New generation, you know, people who think that the young people are from Mars. I think
right.
From Mars. But, you know, name anybody else 77 who doesn't think so, right? I think it comes with the turf when you get old. But on the other hand, we do have, you know, thoughtful young people who are also saying that they're from Mars. So I think there's been a greater generational change to the economic conditions than any that Japan has seen before.
Mm. We often hear about Japan's homogeneity, and however, in the last 10 years or the 10 years that I spent there, I found, in addition to this homogeneous society that we hear a lot about, I found quite a bit of diversity and quite a bit of tolerance for those who are not part of this so-called Japanese family, so to speak. And
you're right, quite right to feel so. I mean, this idea of the homogeneous collection with, you know, all with the same subway face on every day, this is, you know, obviously not true. It's been reported by people who've stayed there a couple of days and don't know Japanese and so forth. Yeah. Japanese are wildly pluralistic as anybody else. I mean, America, for example, prides itself quite properly on its pluralism. Japan ought to do, because it's just as pluralistic and there's just as many minorities, there's just as much minority opinion. But as you point out, the Japanese are favored with two ways to express themselves. One is the social way, mm-hmm. and one is the personal, individual, and private way. One is privileged above the other in that country, well, in this one, too. In this one, we downgrade the official and we upgrade the private, and Japan is just the opposite. So what the observer comes, he gets the official Japan line.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not true any more than is the official American line true. There's too many exceptions to it. You're absolutely right to have noticed the wild pluralism, and with it a curious kind, as you put it quite rightly, of tolerance, which I do find missing in some other countries, where people who don't, you know, aren't pointed in the same direction and are truly, truly, and very often dissident things, are quietly approved of in a way which is uncommon and which I find admirable.
We have another caller. This is line 4 from Bloomington. You're on with Donald Ritchie.
Thank you very much. I have a number of questions, and I'll try to just ask them very quickly. One, what is the status of Article 9 and the dispute about a military force And is there more facing up to the fact that the security force is an incredible military force? Secondly...
Let me answer them one by one, okay?
I'm sorry, what?
Let me answer them one by one.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
As far as Article 9 goes, I remember when Eisenhower finally made it to Japan after not having made it for a while, and they asked, and they mentioned solemnly their constitution. He laughed and said, "You guys still got that piece of paper around? This is a constitution which is not taken seriously by anybody else except the government, the Japanese government, which finds it extremely convenient to take this seriously. But now we've reached a point where its usefulness may very well have finally, after 50 years, been all used up. America is making demands on Japan to have an army again, and although Japan does have an army, it has been given the euphemism of the National Defense Force. And indeed, when the help was wanted in the Gulf War, it did prevent the Japanese from sending troops, all of which was wildly applauded because Japan is the truly pacifist nation. There may be no other, but Japan will fight and fight and fight not to have to go to war again. Mm. And all of its politicians will fight because it would be highly unpopular to declare that they had an imperial army again. So I don't know what it's going to be. I do know that America is going to need all the help that it can, and it's going to ask its allies to do this, and Japan will not be in a position to refuse, and I don't know how it's going to manage to refuse.
I think Japan has offered to send a couple of ships into the area near where the U.S. might need them. I think some hospital ships, something like that, some aid.
Like that. The thing right. is, will America decide this is adequate?
Right. That's a good question. Do you have another question?
Yes. Two more quickly. Mm-hmm. The next one relates to what you were saying about women. There were some studies before trying to show about the use of law, formal law, in Japan. And it was claimed that actually, using a formal legal mechanism helped people, helped groups such as women, the Barakamin, and others, more than the informal mechanisms which we were so lauded here today. And I'm just curious, do you find that there is more appeals to formal legal mechanisms in Japan? Is that increasing? Has that helped women, for example? Or are these more informal dispute resolution mechanisms still prominent?
Well, the government is so maladroit that anything that it does to do to help a social problem does not mitigate it. For example, you mentioned the Barakumin, the pariah class. There's been a law on the books that forbids one to discriminate against them. That law is over 100 years old. And it has never, so far as I know, been actually pushed. I mean, they have these laws, but who's going to put teeth in them? And so even now we have a discrimination against the Brahmin. You know, if you're Brahmin, you can't marry into good society. You're not supposed to be able to get a good job and so forth. Despite all these governmental efforts, there's been very few governmental efforts on the part of women. What women have won have been won by women, not by the government. In fact, there's a grave distrust. A healthy one, I think, of him, for example, film, which is my field.
Let me just interrupt. We were talking with Donald Ritchie, who is the author of a new book on Japan called The Donald Ritchie Reader, 50 Years of Writing on Japan, published by Stonebridge Press. And the caller had one more question, right?
Yes, one quick question.
Okay.
The Japanese apparently... performed the almost on the worst on the TOEFL test, the English-speaking test, further down than North Koreans, for example. And I'm wondering if any improvements have been made in the teaching of English beyond the sort of what was called somewhat nastily Japlish in Japan. Are there any efforts being made to teach English in a different way than it has been in the past?
Not really, although everybody's aware of the problem now. The problem, as I see it, is twofold. One is that teaching methods is based upon the two kana systems, the two syllabary system, which support the originally Chinese kanji system. These three systems have to be learned. And one of the things about the kana system is that everything ends on a vowel. And so you don't get, it's impossible to get proper pronunciation if you are taught using this system, which everybody is. Mm-hmm. And so this means that if you can't pronounce anything differently, then you're too, ashamed to speak out. And that leads to the second problem, which is completely psychological, which is the Japanese don't like to do anything until perfect at it. But mm-hmm. if you don't practice, you can't be perfect, and they don't practice. The Japanese who come abroad and are forced to learn to speak, then they speak very well indeed. However, speaking within Japan is so inhibited, and so it's just not English they're lousy at. They're lousy to all languages.
That's very true. It's the way I think I've been in classrooms where they were teaching English, and it's almost rote-like. There's very little interaction, very little conversation, and then the conversation is done. They follow the lead of the instructor, who is often mispronouncing, and it creates a pattern of...
True. English is taught like Latin, like it's a dead language.
Exactly. You've written a lot of books on Japan. I'm just curious to know what your favorite book is, the one that you seem to like the best.
The one that I like is the one that I least thought about when I was writing it, the one that is much more of a romantic outpouring. That is The Inland Sea.
Hmm. Now, why did you pick that book? Why is that your favorite?
It doesn't have the mediation of scholarship.
Hmm.
It's completely impressionistic. It's al fresco. That's, I think, one of the reasons I like it. Also, it's the freshest. And even though it is more a novel than it is a real travel book, and that is made up, nonetheless, the persona is very persuasive, learning things like this. And the things that he learns are all things which fly in the face of, you know, what accepted learning consists of in Japan. The book is being, it's been out of print for 5 years, but next year there's going to be a new edition.
Hmm.
And I'm very happy to see this this book of mine reinstated. I think that's my best book.
Do you think, will you be writing a new intro to the book? Or?
Yes, I did. I went to the MSC last month just to find out what it was like. I hadn't really been there for 30 or 40 years.
Hmm.
And I found out what it was like, and that is going to form the basis of what I read at the end of the new edition.
Just describe, for those who've never been there, describe the Inland Sea as you wrote about it then and maybe as you see it now when you went back.
Well, the Inland Sea is a long strait, actually, between the islands of Honshu and Shikoku, which includes many, many islands. It's the most legendary beauty. It looks like Maxfield Parrish paintings. It's extraordinarily beautiful. And in a land where beauty has been sacrificed to function long ago, it stands out as one of the most aesthetically pleasing. Since these are islands, these people are cut off mainly from each other. And so one can find strata, historical strata of Japanese as it was, you know, Japanese in various stages of Western enlightenment there. I found people who, when I attempted to speak to them in perfectly adequate Japanese, would, you know, wave their hands in front of their faces and say, no English, no English. And so you can find, you know, the Japanese, as it were, down in among the layers, and that's always very interesting. And one of the things about the book is about the voyaging among these various layers. Also, you can find that history is alive to varying degrees. History is usually alive to the Japanese, but you can find the degrees with which it's practiced. And I'm going south through this mass of gorgeous islands, and I end up Miyajima, the great shrine at Miyajima, and all of Kyushu still beckons, and that's the end of the thing. It is, in a way, a delshun roman, you know, it's the author coming to terms with himself.
Mm-hmm.
Learning up to give, he doesn't have to think of them as them anymore, because he has been given the gift through this trip of identifying himself to the extent that he doesn't need them to hold him up anymore. He can see them as real things rather than just as things that he's posited to get himself through life.
We have one more caller from Chicago. Line 4, you're on with Donald Ritchie.
Thank you. General MacArthur, towards the end of his career, remarked about what he felt was the futility of war. And I'd like to further extend the observation that about the folly and irony of war, in that Germany, Japan, and Italy were at one time our enemies, and now they are somewhat our allies, and the extent that we can learned that peaceful, constructive, creative cooperation and harmony is advancing the cause of, for all of us, any much, much further than destructive elements of war. And I was wondering if you had any other observations along those lines.
Well, naturally, I'm all in favor of it, but I also feel that this is something which you only occur after, occurs to you after you've done all the damage. I mean, General MacArthur certainly did his you know, two hands full. And then he came to the realization that, in fact, it is old soldiers who come to this realization and not young warriors.
Yes.
I hesitate to say human nature since I don't really believe such a thing exists, but watching the destructive ability of human beings, I would say that what we're talking about is a utopian state which none of us will ever live to see. I mean, it's a wonderful thought, and it is practical. I mean, we would gain much more than simply through the destruction of war, but I personally, given the kind of animals we live with, I really don't believe so.
Hmm. Well, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you, we haven't had a chance to really get to it, and we won't have a whole lot of time now, but some of your best writing, I think, deals with Japanese film, and that seems to be a first love of yours. Tell us a little bit about Japanese film and why you find it so compelling.
Well, I suppose to account for this, I'd first have to account for film. Back in Ohio, when I was very young, I was put into the theaters. I mean, this is one of the ways to keep children quiet. And I sort of, you know, saw this new reality, this authenticity, which I preferred to the one that I was being subjected to. And so in no time at all, my father had taken back seat to Johnny Weissmuller, and my mother might cry, but I didn't. And but when Norma Shearer did, I did. And so this new reality absolutely revived my interest in being alive, and I grew to prefer it. This is true of many of my generation who learn to see through the film, to feel through the film. The film is a great educative thing, whether it intended to be so or not. And so consequently, I learned about my own civilization through seeing it through the paradigm of the film. So when I went to a new country with a new civilization, naturally my mode of gaining knowledge was to turn to film again in order to understand what film was reflecting. And this was aided in Japan by the fact that the cinema was going through an neorealism phase in which the people on the screen were exactly like the people whose houses I passed when I went home after seeing the film in the theater. And so I was able to put two and two together with a feeling of equability than I would ordinarily have been able to do. The pictures were showing people as they were. They were not yet showing people pictures as they would want to be, which, of course, is what all film does now. And so I was able to take advantage of this in order to use it as a learning tool in order to understand Japan. That has always been the main role of film. It's to elucidation. I think my life has been about attempts at elucidation. And the film has certainly been a major tool in this.
Well, I think that's a very good description of what you've done since you've been in Japan. Now, you're headed where? To New York now? Your next stop is New York?
Yes, I'm on this tour flogging my book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to flog some more in New York, and then I go to Boston, and then Harvard has asked me to give a big speech there. So I'm going to talk in Hartford, and I'm going to take a few days off in Martha's Vineyard, and then go back home.
And home is Tokyo?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right. Now, do you plan to stay there for the rest of your life? Do you think you might come back to this country ever again?
It has all that many options. I mean, coming back to this country is barely an option. I prefer life there.
Well, I appreciate your joining us, and I wish you the best of success with the book. It's a fascinating read. Anybody who is interested and has any interest at all in Japan would do well to pick this up and take a look at it, because it provides people with such a broad perspective of this very interesting country.
Well, I thank you very much for a most intelligent interview.
Well, I appreciate it, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Coming up next is the market report, and then following that, we have the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn. And I thank you for joining us, and I will talk to you again.